I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with John Luther Adams, one of the preeminent American composers of our moment. He's best known for structuring giant orchestral sheets of harmony in a sort of slow motion, vast meditative seascapes like this one that won the Pulitzer Prize in 2014. Alex Ross in The New Yorker called it the loveliest apocalypse in musical history. The composer calls it Become Ocean. He remembers writing it with visions in his head of polar ice caps melting and seas rising. Out of the wilderness of his own Alaska years, John Luther Adams makes music that is embedded in the natural environment and our anxieties about it. In this hour, we're talking about his journey from the tundra to the concert hall and the big ideas that run under it, like this one, that the whole world is music. I met Adams for the first time this winter in his Manhattan apartment just south of Harlem.
Door open.
He's a lean man with a light beard in his early 60s.
Hey. Welcome.
How do you do, sir? Thank you.
It's right what people say, that John Luther Adams could remind you of Clint Eastwood. In the bare kitchen of his airy studio, with the sound of traffic, fire engines, and a few birds in the distance, our conversation is about making music in an atmosphere of anxiety. 2016.
Where's to begin? You write about tuning, and you write about place and ambient sound and your music. Just draw us in to that insight and that process.
Well, it all begins with listening. Listening takes time. Listening is a way of touching and being touched across a distance. And I think it helps us when we're really listening to where we are, wherever that may be, we come to hear that the whole world is music. And as we listen to the world that way, we begin to understand not only where we are, but who we are, and how our voices, how our presence in the world fits into that larger, never-ending music of the world. Does that make any sense?
Makes a lot of sense. I listen to you night and day on my big Sonos system. And, I mean, you strike so many interesting chords there, but it is music about space and location. It takes you places. I never know where, but then, I don't know, maybe that's part of what I wanted to find out. Where we go when we listen to your music?
Wherever you need to go, wherever the music takes you. I don't know any better than you do. And I'm not interested in telling you where to go, in painting you a specific picture or taking you to a specific place. So my hope is for you as a listener is the same thing that I want for myself. I want to hear something I haven't heard before. I want to find myself and maybe lose myself in a place that I've never been and that may be ravishingly beautiful, maybe threatening and ominous, but a place that strikes deep resonances and allows each of us as a listener to find our own way, to have our own experience. For me, music is worthy of a life's devotion, and music is so essential to what it means to be human because it always knows more than we do.
Thank you. take your point that we want to hear something we've never heard before, but with all due respect, I keep hearing all the music I've ever heard in your music, and fragments and suggestions and ideas. For example, listen to the beginning of The Farthest Place. I hear Miles Davis, all blues. It sounds like it. But then in other ways, I think of all the water music we've ever heard. In some of those long passages that hang on a chord, I hear almost a joke that somebody made about McCoy Tyner after John Coltrane was gone. Somebody saying, I heard McCoy Tyner the other night. What did he play? Well, he played an E-flat minor seventh chord for a long, long time. And then he played a G-sharp major seventh for a long, long time. I also hear late Beethoven. I hear late Schubert. All things come back eventually to the posthumous piano sonata in B-flat.
Yeah, well, that's some of the most sublime music ever.
But it's also otherworldly. It's a view of us and life in Vienna, I suppose, and all music from his impending death, from another place. It is truly transcendental music. And your music seems to go to the same unknown place.
Well, what to say about that?
How does it feel, Mr. Schubert?
It's overwhelming. You know, and I don't doubt you. I'm delighted that you hear and feel all of those things. I'm surprised, but then again...
Why surprised?
Should I be? Because I don't necessarily hear any of those things. And yet, perhaps it's all there. And maybe that's because it all comes ultimately from the same place. We human animals don't really create anything, in my view. I would say that everything we are, the very shape of our minds, ultimately derives from this miraculous, mysterious world that we inhabit. So maybe when McCoy Tyner or Franz Schubert or John Luther Adams get close to that heartbeat, to that breath of the world, we are all contained within that, and we're all tapping in ultimately to the same thing.
There are lots of other connections. Can I try one or two?
Sure.
I mean, we know, in a visual culture, a screen culture, but one of the things I hear in your music is a kind of wake-up call. No. We live in an oral culture. We live through our ears. My revelation on that point was a guy named Tony Schwartz who made commercials. He made the famous Lyndon Johnson Girl with the Daisy Pedal.
Right.
He made Coca-Cola. It's the real thing commercials. And at one point in my life, I showed him early television stuff I had done, and he said, Chris, you're still working for the New York Times. You're trying to cram information through that lens. It doesn't work that way. Broadcasting is a medium of effects, not of information. But to think anew about ways we get things, I listen to your music and say, oh my God, we should be listening more carefully. Including those long moments in your pieces where a chord is sustained, but the instrumentation changes. We'll hear the harp, we'll hear the piano, we'll hear low brass or something.
Right. For me, that's somewhat analogous to just the way the light is changing in this room. And, you know, the music doesn't go anywhere in conventional terms of linear development. But what I hope is the experience of listening to those moments, those long suspended moments in my music, is like sitting in a place and feeling the weather change, feeling the air change, watching the light change. And I think the longer we stay in one place, the more we notice change.
Sounds right.
And the more we notice change, the more we understand where we are and what it means to be there, how we fit in, and ultimately who we are. And when we move outside, when we take our earbuds out, when we step outside the concert hall and into the big world, we have no choice but to try and listen outward, to try and hear as many different sounds as we can hear, from as far away as we may be able to hear. It's a much more extroverted mode of awareness. And I think we need that.
And in this world, we have to work at it too, I think.
You know, it can be hard work. It can also be magical. You know, think of a hunter out in the forest or out on the tundra. You know, the hunter has to be attuned to everything all around.
That was something Tony Schwartz taught me too. That on the plains of East Africa 10,000 years ago, that was us. And we learned more, he would tell you, by ear than by any sign or speech.
Yes.
And what, even with speech, what we're listening for is threat or danger or support or affection or something. But we're listening to everything.
Absolutely.
Here's more of The Farthest Place from 2002. Coming up, the architectural forms inside John Luther Adams' music. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source, sitting with John Luther Adams, the composer, in his apartment near 112th Street in South Harlem. Adams makes expansive music that adheres to strict mathematical measures. His Pulitzer Prize piece, Become Ocean, for example, plays out like a palindrome or a mirror image, the notes in the last half precisely reflecting the notes in the first.
I'd just love to know, how does Become Ocean get written on paper? You're anything but a form-free composer. There is a deep architecture and oftentimes a sort of symmetry in the way this music works. Mm-hmm. How does that happen?
Well, the symmetry is, and the deep architecture, the formalism, is there to protect the music against the bad taste of the composer. The mathematics, the geometry, the architecture, the formalism of my music is a kind of discipline that I employ because I find it fascinating and inherently, but also it is a kind of discipline that reminds me that it's about the music. It's not about me. For me, music is not a means of self-expression. If I want to tell you a story, I'll tell you a story. If I want to relate some specific idea, I'll write words, or we'll have a conversation. Music is something else for me. And I don't mean to say that this is the only way music can be. I don't even know what music is. It's my life's work, but I have no idea what music is. And you know what? Music doesn't care what I think it is. And music can be anything that it wants to be. And maybe it can be anything that we want it to be. But I am interested in music as a discipline, as a spiritual path, as something beyond expression, as a way of connecting with something elemental. For me, music is inseparable from nature, and I don't mean that in any kind of poetic or programmatic or illustrative sense. it is just as we are, part of nature. You know, the famous story about somebody asked Jackson Pollock, Mr. Pollock, why don't you paint from nature? And he snapped back, I am nature. And I feel the same way. So, I got way off from your question.
No, but I was reminded, though, and it's maybe the false connection with the way African-American jazz musicians especially speak about the music.
Uh-huh.
As to say, it's not me.
No, it's not.
It's a tradition. It has its own history and integrity and maybe rules. And it's our job to work with it. But it's not...
Yes, and it's even and it's even more than that. In the moment, it's a force. It's one might say it's a being. It's a presence. It's an awareness of our consciousness that contains us. That's why it's the music.
As in the sirens.
Right. I love the sirens.
You do?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. And I love them just as sound now. I don't love them as emblematic. I don't love them. Yes, I love them because they remind me of Varese. Yes, I love them because they're emblematic of New York. Yes, I fear them because it means that maybe somebody's in trouble or even more darkly that it evokes war and horror. But, you know, they're also sounds, and they're beautiful. They're like a pack of wolves howling over the next mountain ridge.
We don't know where the music comes from, but we need to know more. I want to hear where you come from. Mississippi. Milton Babbitt came from Mississippi.
Yeah, well,
I barely came
from Mississippi. I lived in Mississippi, I think, 18 months. I was born there. But I grew up all over the lower 48, as we provincial Alaskans say. And as a result, you know, my dad was climbing the corporate ladder with the phone company back when it was the phone company, right? There was only one.
AT&T.
Yeah.
My father's company.
Yep. So we should form a support group. But it was a little bit like being almost like being a military brat in that as my dad was climbing the corporate ladder, we moved every few years. So we lived down south. We lived here in the suburbs of New York City. I went to music school in California. And, you know, when people would talk about home, I didn't know what they meant. I had no idea where home was. And I think without understanding fully what I was doing, I went looking for home. I went looking for the place to which I could belong in the deepest sense.
Your karmic space, as they said in your time.
And I was so blessed to discover that at the tender age of 22. When I first set foot in Alaska, I knew instantly that I had come home. And I discovered my true family there. I discovered my life's work there. And I certainly discovered my true home.
What was the music in your life before music school? What took you there?
Rock and roll. I was
a drummer, right?
A drummer in a series of garage bands, and some of them were pretty good, and I probably could have had a life in that music, but the truth is I got bored with it. It just didn't... There wasn't enough there musically to engage my imagination, and through following my ears and my natural curiosity with some good guidance along the way from the likes of Frank Zappa, I discovered this whole other world of music, which engaged me in a much more complete and exciting way than rock and roll ever did. And I was probably 15, 16 when I first heard a little piece of Morton Feldman, a piece called Piece for Four Pianos, which I think was from 1957. Anyway, I got this LP. I would go to the record stores in those days. There were such things as record stores where one went to buy recordings. And I would go into the record stores and rummage through the bins and look for the strangest covers or the things that I'd never heard of and buy those. And one day I came home with this album with this kind of formidable-looking guy sitting on the deck of the Staten Island Ferry with his thick glasses and a cigarette dangling out of his mouth and his trench coat and his fedora cocked just so and leg crossed and looking into the camera like daring you to pick a fight. And it was hot pink also. And the title was Morton Feldman, The Early Years. And all I knew about Morton Feldman at that point was that he was a pal of John Cage, who was already one of my heroes. So I grabbed this album, bought it, brought it home, put it on, and dropped the needle on Piece for Four Pianos. And I went to a place that Pink Floyd just couldn't take me. And it was a 7 or 8 minute piece, and I picked up the needle and put it back to the beginning and played it again and again and again. And sometime during that listening session, I realized, yeah, this is what I want to do with my life. Was another moment in my life. It would have been, boy, just a few years later. The difference between 15 and 21 is just 6 years, isn't it? So I had already gone to music school at CalArts. I was in the first graduating class at CalArts in 1973. Hated Los Angeles. Got the hell out of there as quickly as I could and went looking for home. And I wound up living with my girlfriend, who became my first wife, on this old farm in rural Georgia. And I was a farmhand there. And each morning early and again around sunset, I would take long walks in the woods. And I would hear deep in the forest this haunting ethereal music. And I'd try to approach the singer and it would always recede. It would always seem to be at the same distance. And I just couldn't get enough of it. In time, I started trying to write down what I was hearing. And then I came to learn, I got a bird book. I came to learn this is the wood thrush. And then I remembered, oh, this was Thoreau's favorite bird song. The song of that bird evoked this deep, inarticulate sense of longing in me. And I think I've been following that ever since. Mm. And what was that about? Longing for what? I think in some sense it's a longing to be more fully present and to feel more fully at home in the world. I think that's what the song of the wood thrush stirred in me.
Where do we hear the transformation of that longing, maybe that bird song, in your work?
Well, I immediately set out, you know, again, I was 21, right? This is 1974. I started writing a extended cycle of pieces for piccolos and percussion instruments called simply Songbird Songs. And although there are pieces that predate that music, in a very real sense, that's Opus 1. That's kind of ground zero for my life's work, those little bird pieces. And I worked on those for several years and had sketches, notebooks filled with sketches for many, many more. But with the self-consciousness of the young artiste, I said, no, I don't want this to become a shtick. I don't want to become the bird guy. I'm going to put these down now.
Not a bad guy to be, actually.
Well, you know, and I knew that there was that other bird guy, that French bird guy, Messiaen.
Messiaen, I was thinking.
But I didn't want anything to do with him. Because, again, with the self-consciousness of a young artist, I didn't want to be influenced. So I avoided the Catalogue d'Oiseaux for years. And now I revel in, you know, the difference between Messiaen's birds and mine. Anyway, I put them down and said, okay, I'll come back to these when I'm older. Maybe this is an old age project. Well, I'm now in my 60s, and in fact, I have come back in recent years to bird songs as a source, as a spring for my music. And there's a way in which those very early pieces, those songbird songs, prefigure or foreshadow a piece like Inuksuit, the outdoor piece for up to 99 percussionists. There's a performance practice. There's a conception of open form and musical time that is not metered, but flows more like time does in the world. So that's another epiphany, those early bird works, the early bird music.
The music here comes from that John Luther Adams piece, Inuksuit. It was recorded outdoors in Vermont in 2013. Coming up, the young composers venture into wilderness politics at a formative moment in Alaska. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source in John Luther Adams's apartment in New York. The composer is speaking about musical and political ideas formed, in his case, by the sounds of different landscapes, from Georgia farmland to the Alaskan tundra.
John, in Alaska, you discovered the wilderness, as very few people get to do. Mm-hmm. But you also got preoccupied with the threat to this nature you teach us how to identify with. Recount that, the discovery of environmental Luther Adams.
You know, it actually, again, that came from the birds. Right about the same time that I was discovering birds and the music of birds and the larger music of the earth and my own music within that, I became aware of environmental issues in a broader sense. And even before I went to Alaska for the first time in 1975, when I was 22, I was already aware of the growing campaign to protect large tracts of original landscape in Alaska. And I got involved in the campaign for the Alaska Lands Act. First working for the Alaska Coalition, I lobbied in Congress in Washington, D.C. I toured around the West and did road shows trying to rouse the rabble to write their members of Congress to support creating these new national parks and wildlife refuges and wilderness areas. And then I went to Alaska and I was for several years executive director of the Northern Alaska Environmental Center. This is when I was still in my 20s and into my early 30s. And in 1980, December 8th, 1980, President Jimmy Carter signed the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which is the single largest land preservation act in history. And the small role that I played in that moment remains among the most satisfying experiences of my life. To be a young person in Alaska, especially at that time in the 1970s, but at any time, to be a young person in Alaska, it's a very, very heady experience. And back then, there was a sense of openness and possibility that I've never felt anyplace else. There was a sense of beginning something, of really designing a society. Mm. And I still, in the face of our increasingly dysfunctional political system and the Exxon Valdez and climate change and Sarah Palin and, you know, all these awful things that have come and gone since those days, I still cling to something of that vision of how things might be, of how things really are. Hmm.
What was the sound of Alaska in the 70s, and how did it infiltrate your music then and now?
Well, I think the sound of Alaska in the 70s was the sound of Alaska now, at least when you get away from the roads and the towns and out into what I think of as the real Alaska, in the mountains and the forests and on the lakes and in the tundra. There's that sense of being in touch with rhythms, with vibrations, with sounds that may or may not be actually audible to our ears, that are so deep and so big and so old and so powerful that we're frightened by them, we're threatened by them, we're ravished by them. They take our breath away. It's a primal music that's still out there.
John Luther Adams composed The Light That Fills the World in 1998 in Fairbanks. For the liner notes of the CD, Adams describes a harmonic world that evolves like slowly changing light on a timeless field. The open field seems to stand for Adams' music. He feels landscape as the binding force of culture.
I suppose it gets to this question that I'm beginning to explore in my work, this relationship between solitude and community. I am by nature an introvert. My work requires me at times to be very extroverted, to be in public situations and to talk and interact with people in rehearsals and performances and in conversations like this one. But fundamentally, my work is solitary. The primary work is in the studio alone. And by temperament, I'm a little bit of a misanthrope and definitely an introvert. So for years, you know, I retreated to my splendid isolation in Alaska. I lived up there for decades and really didn't want much to do with the rest of the world. And this went on until even recently. And maybe I started to understand where the music was leading me with Inuksuit. It's a piece I composed in 2009. This is the first outdoor work. It's for up to 99 percussionists, and it's to be performed only out of doors. And Inuksuit is inspired in part by the stone sentinels that the Inuit people have constructed in the Arctic for centuries. These extraordinary markers of the passing of humans in a vast landscape. And each Inuksuk stands out up there on the Arctic coastal plain as a singular figure, as a solitary presence in the big world. So in my composition, Inuksuit, each musician is a soloist, and I conceive of each listener as a solitary figure. It's an outdoor piece, so there's no best seat in the house. There's no idealized or privileged listening position. The best place to hear Inuksuit is wherever you are. So I imagine this piece was about solitude. Trick on me. It turns out that it's a piece about community. Because we may be listening from our own unique positions, but out of the shared experience of our individual listening emerges this larger sense of a shared experience, that we're all in something bigger than we are. Mm. And each of us may have our own, will have our own singular version of that experience. But I've seen it happen again and again with Inuksuit and more recently with Sila, the new...
The Breath of the World.
The Breath of the World, the new outdoor piece. That after the music stops, there's this extraordinary sense of community. So maybe in some way that's an idealized model of human society.
Let's speak of Ilamak, especially because it brings forward the drummer, Glenn Kochi, mm-hmm. in a special way. What's going on here? What it took me a lifetime to learn was that the drummer is the center of every band, in a way. Mm-hmm. How did this collaboration come about, and what does it mean to you?
Well, I came of age as a drummer. And I'm a recovering percussionist. Haven't picked up a drumstick in 12 years now. But I began musical life as a drummer. And as you say, there's something just fundamental about the position of the drummer in music throughout the world, in cultures throughout history around the world. Specifically in Alaska Native tradition, the drummer is someone who rides the sound to and from the spirit world. Translated more or less literally from Inupiaq, the title Ilimak means spirit journey. It's an odd piece. It took 20 years to evolve. But Glenn Kochi is an extraordinary drummer. He's the drummer perhaps I always imagined that I could be. I knew of Wilco. I don't pay much attention to pop music anymore. But I got a lovely email from several years ago now. Got a lovely email from Glenn, who said that Wilco was coming to Fairbanks, to my hometown, and that he was a big fan of my music, and he would just like to meet. So we had dinner together, and then I went to the performance, and I got the backstage view of Glenn's world. And I was really taken with Glenn as a musician and as a human being. Sometime later, he asked me if I would consider composing a piece for him, and I readily agreed. And the result is Ilimak.
Lucky you. Lucky him.
Yeah, it's kind of a match made in heaven.
Speak of this soundscape we're all in these days. On 116th Street, in our offices, at home, beeps everywhere, all kinds of commercial or traffic sounds. It seems to have crossed a line in the last, what, 8, 10 years, maybe 5. What do you hear out there? And how does a musician either embrace it or, you know, deeper into the soundproof chamber?
When I'm waiting for a subway and the express train goes by, I plug my ears. I plug my ears because I'm trying to protect my hearing. I don't plug my ears because I think it's an ugly sound. I actually think it's a beautiful sound. I think there are no ugly sounds. There's a question of health and safety. But generally speaking, I try to keep my ears as open as I possibly can. Earbud free, finger free, and open to the sounds around me all the time, wherever I may be. You know, Cage said back in the 30s that most of what we hear around us most of the time is noise. And when we try to ignore it, when we try to shut it out, it disturbs us. But when we open our ears to it, we find it endlessly fascinating. And I think where that leads us eventually is to the realization that the whole world is music. And if we feel that kind of embeddedness in the world and that sort of responsibility for our position in the world, the sounds that we make in the world, then we're going to be better off than if we try to exclude things and keep things out. It can't be. In listening, just as in society, we have to be as open and as inclusive as we possibly can be.
John Luther Adams, I came to meet you, I think, really to find out what it was I was drawn to in this music. And I think maybe the answer is it's just the example of a man listening faithfully, slowly, curiously.
For me, it all begins with listening.
You're helping us listen, and not just to your music. Thank you.
Thank you for this conversation.
The composer John Luther Adams is based in New York. His latest record, produced in collaboration with Glenn Kochi, is called Illimac. It's available through Cantaloupe Records, along with all the other music you heard this hour, at johnlutheradams.bandcamp.com. The program was produced and edited by Connor Gillies, with help from Max Larkin, Zach Goldhammer, and Abby Duker. George Hicks mixed the show. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lighton. Join us next time on Open Source.